And the thing that I'm going to argue or try to demonstrate is that it's the growth of this operator that is analogous to the butterfly effect. And along the way, we will use this to diagnose chaos, scrambling, and complexity. And of course, to diagnose something, you need to define it. So I hope to both present definitions of what I mean by these terms and then argue how they're related. So before we begin, there's been a lot of recent interest in these fields. They're, of course, or I'm going to argue that they're related, so the segregation is a bit arbitrary. I want to draw special attention to the work of Steve Shanker and Douglas Stanford for really bringing attention or understanding how to think about chaos, specifically with respect to holography. And this talk will cover sort of a nice selection from these different categories. Okay, so to begin, let's talk about chaos and the butterfly effect. And we're going to start with a very simple system, a spin chain. It's a concrete, one-dimensional system. It's about as concrete as you can get. I'm going to use this Hamiltonian. It has a Ising-like interaction. It has a transverse field. It has a parallel field. And I'm going to use x, y, z to represent the Pauli operators. Subscript indicates the site on which they act. And I generally runs from 1 to n. When I have to pick n, I'll pick n equals 8 when I'm going to do some sort of mutex. Similarly, when I have to pick g and h, I'm going to pick g equals minus 1.05 and h equals 0.5. But really what I'm saying should be taken to be understood as just statements about generic values of these parameters. And for n large, where large in general means, in principle, means just, for instance, larger than 4 to see the sorts of effects that I'm talking about. Good. So we're just going to start by trying to attack the problem directly and see how far we can get, and then once we and see what we can learn. So this is the sort of thing that I want to consider. This is this Pauli z operator acting on the first site of the spin chain. And I'm just going to evolve it in time using the Hamiltonian from the previous slide.
Isn't that Hamiltonian integrable?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that Hamiltonian?
It's only integrable when, for instance, g equals 1 and h equals 0. So this additional term makes it non-integrable. We will see precisely why this is true, or the way in which this is true. So when g equals 1 and h equals 0, that's the transverse quantum Ising model. And that's, for instance, a well-known system. It's related to the two-dimensional formal field theory. But when you have this additional term, it's not integrable.
But I thought that I think the critical theory plus magnetic field is integrable. So.
Yeah, also, you could sort of start lining a little some choices to generate a speaker from something.
Okay, well, in general, first of all, depends, there are lots of definitions of interval, but I don't think for generic values of this parameter, it satisfies any of them, but we can, let me go on and explain and we can discuss after. So I want to evolve this operator with this Hamiltonian, and attack this directly. And so what we can do is we can expand this using the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff relation. And so what we see is that we get an expansion in terms of both, well, any expansion in parameter gives you a power, a series in that parameter. So we have terms that go like 2 to the k over k factorial. But what we see is that in general, these terms involve nested commutators with a Hamiltonian. And so larger terms later on in the series involve lots of these nested commutators. So to understand what happens to this operator under time evolution, we should try and understand these commutators. So let's just compute some directly. So here, I start with the operator z1, and I take the commutator of the Hamiltonian, and I get y1. Note, in this brief section, I'm going to be suppressing the g and h dependence for the reasons that will become clear very quickly. So good. So it only doesn't commute with this term, and so we get this. We just get one term. Now let's take another commutator. Here, y1 doesn't commute with any of the terms in the Hamiltonian, and so we get three different terms. We get x, z, we get x1, z1, and we also get x1, z2. So note that due to the fact that the y1 didn't commute with the Ising-like term, the operator has now grown to have support on two sites, so we've increased, there's a term with support on two sites. Good. So we'll see that this pattern continues as we continue to take these commutators of these strings, not only proliferate, but they also grow long. And this pattern, the way to think about this is that the strings can grow an additional length of one every time, every two different nested commutators. So first, you start with something that, for instance, terminates in a Z, and it has to be switched used by not commuting with the transverse term to, say, a Y before it can not commute with the eigenlength ZZ term and grow longer. And so we see that this this pattern emerges in general. And in fact, if we, So what we see is that later terms in this series involve sums of products of local operators. So it's a very, it'll be an operator that has support on increasing part of this, increasing range of the spin chain, and also the operator is being dominated by strings of higher and higher weight. So really, in order to understand how this operator is actually growing, we need to restore the time dependence. So let's do that, and then let's also try and understand a way of measuring the size of, or ultimately what we're after is a way of measuring the size of the operator. So in order to do that, we should figure out a way of measuring this operator. And so we're going to do that by considering this following commutator. So this is a commutator of the operator we're trying to consider, Z1 of t, with a second simple local operator, Z of j. And in general, j should be taken to be not equal to 1. So what this is a commutator of operators that are separated both in space and in time. And we're going to square it to avoid phase cancellations, take the minus sign to ensure that it's positive, and then average it over a state of interest, in this case, the thermal ensemble. And my claim is that this is a measure of the strength of the butterfly effect at site J. So it measures the effects of the earlier perturbation of Z1 on later measurements of Z at J, and vice versa. And so let's try and understand both why this is a measure of size and how this lets us understand the time dependence of this operator. So first, let's think about this as at fixed J. So at fixed fixed J. So at t equals 0, I have two simple local operators that have non-overlapping support, and so they commute. That's what we see over here. Now, as I begin to increase t, we saw that on the previous set of slides that strings of higher and higher weight are becoming more and more important. So the later terms in that series that we expanded are suppressed by t to the k over k factorial. So for small t, only the initial terms matter, but as we increase t, the latter terms become more and more important, which involves strings of longer and longer length and weight. So at some point, strings that are of length j will begin to dominate, and this commutator will no longer be zero, the operators will cease to commute, and so we get this very quick rise to some wait time value, and then it stays constant for a long time. So the picture here is that this operator is growing outwards, and eventually it ceases to commute with an operator at j. Alternatively, we can study this commutator at fixed t. And so what this is, I will argue is a very natural measure of the size of our operator. So we're at fixed t, so there's some finite radius of our operator. It's a sum of a bunch of different terms, and we probe it by using the second operator, zj. So we start at the first site, and we see that it doesn't commute. And we keep moving the operator zj until we get to the point where it begins to commute again. And this is probing our operator, and it's precisely a measure of size. So we can, for instance, define the size to be the point right where it begins to commute again. For instance, the point right where the commutator is equal to its midpoint. So we see that it doesn't commute, and then it very quickly drops off and then begins to commute again towards the end. And sorry, I should say that these plots are generated using exact diagonalization numerical techniques with the parameters that I mentioned in the beginning of this section. Good. So now that we have a notion of size, we can address the question of growth. we see is, oh, sorry, so this just reiterates what I said on the last slide. So the natural definition of size is the place where this commutator is equal to its midpoint. So it's the J star such that this is true, and so that defines the size. And the reason I have one in quotes here is just because it's only, the midpoint is only one for these spin variables. Were I to use other variables, it would not be, it, you'd have to normalize it so that this is true. Good. So now we can address the question of growth. And so the question of growth, so we can use our notion of size and study it as a function of time. And what we find is, the growth is ballistic. It's linear in time. It's a staircase because that notion of size is only defined at each lattice site for integer values, but of course, in a continuum, this would smooth out, and what we get is this nice picture of a linear growth of this operator until it reaches the end of the chain, spin chain, which is of 8 spins, and then it saturates at 8 for a very long time. Were this were an integrable system, the operator would either not grow at all, or it would grow and reach the end and then have a recurrence and then immediately begin to shrink down. So this is a robust phenomenon is a manifestation of the butterfly effect, and it's a robust measure of whether the system is integrable. To sort of address that in a more general sense, so I'm now ready to explain what I mean by the butterfly effect in chaos. So again, this is the commutator that we were studying before on the previous slides, and as a reminder, it measures the effects of perturbations V on later measurements of W and vice versa. And so the claim is that for all simple Hermitian operators, W and V, each having order one energy and localized at x and y, so separated by some distance apart, separated by distance and time, that this commutator should grow. It should start out small and it should grow. And the claim of chaos is that this should happen for all choices of operators W and V. This is in some sense analogous to the classical definition of chaos. Classical definition of butterfly effect, is I make a small perturbation to the system and it grows to have an exponential effect on the system at some later time. Here the claim is that I act with a very simple operator in the system and it grows to have large commutators with all the other operators on the system at a later time. And so we can expand this in terms of correlation functions. One reason to do this is that correlation functions are a natural object of computation, for instance, in quantum field theory. And so so we can analyze chaos in terms of these correlation functions. And so there are two different types of terms here. Note that the operators are ordered as I've written them. And so there's no time, these are not implicitly time ordered, they're ordered exactly as I've written them. And so let's look at these red ordered terms, these red terms first. And so what these are in a sense the norm of a perturbed thermal state. So here I start with the operator V at t equals 0, and then it's a small perturbation, and then I evolve as a thermal state, so the perturbation dissolves back into the thermal suit, and then I apply the operator W at time t. And then this is basically a norm of that state, so for a two-point function in that perturbed thermal state. So it's the two-point function of the W, and I have normalized by the fact that I perturbed it with V. And so this is what I mean, again, by one. It's in quotes, if I had space, I divide, I'd normalize this by these two-point functions, but instead, it goes to some constant late time value. Now, these terms are different. These are ordered in an alternating fashion. For instance, here, I first evolve in time, and then I apply W, and then I evolve back and apply V versus, and it's an inner product with the state where instead I apply V first, and then I evolve and I apply W. And of course, so at early times, this commutator is zero, and for instance, in relativistic theories, outside the light cone of these operators, when they're space-like separated, it has to be zero by causality. And so, of course, we're free to move operators around inside the correlation functions, and of course, these will cancel. Of course, this must be true if the commutator is zero. But then, we know that at later times, the representation of this operator W is growing. We saw this explicitly for this in the spin chain example, and at some point it's going to reach V, and this commutator is going to grow. So if the commutator is going to grow and these terms are constant, then these terms have to decay. And so these alternatingly ordered terms that I've put in blue will decay exponentially in time after a delay related to the distance between the operators. And so the role of chaos is to decorrelate in this sense, that or the role of chaos is that this commutator grows. And so claim is that this is a basic diagnostic of quantum chaos. Yes, go ahead.
How do you define simple operators? Is there anything you're asking?
Yeah, so they're operators of low weight. They're operators, for instance, in terms of the spin variables that are, that just apply to a small, you know, number of sites or one site, and Okay, any other questions? Good. So to try and understand how this works, I'm going to present an example model computation of these correlation functions in model or 1+1 dimensional conformal field theories. So let's see how this works. So I'm going to consider 1+1 dimensional CFT and try and understand how to compute these correlation functions, both for a large central charge CFT with a sparse low-lying spectrum and for a well-known integrable system, the 2D Ising model. This is the configuration of operators that I'm considering, and in general, I'll be interested in a very late time-like limit. And the other point I want to make is that I will, since both of these correlation functions are in fact not time ordered, the interesting one for chaos is this alternating order. And to make it easy to see, I'm going to, for the rest of the section, leave these blue and leave these red so it's clear what I'm talking about. Good. So in order to compute this, we need to consider a related quantity, which is the Euclidean four-point function. The Euclidean four-point function is defined for z bar equals z star. And all Wideman functions are known to be analytic continuations of each other. So what we can do is, we hold z bar fixed, we can analytically continue for independent z. And in a complex z plane, there's a branch cut running from the insertion of the w operator to the insertion of the v operator at 1 to the insertion of the v operator at infinity. And here I've just normalized by two-point functions. The other thing I have to tell you is that this coordinate z on the plane is related to the coordinates, Lorentzian coordinates of interest on the cylinder, x and t, in this way. And so the late time limit of t much greater than x corresponds to z equals 0. So we'll be interested in the behavior of this correlation function, perhaps on different sheets, as we take z to 0. So let's understand how to compute these correlation functions. So the procedure is as follows. We start with Lorentzian time 0 for all the operators, and we give each operator a Euclidean time that is ordered in the way that we wish the operators to be ordered in the correlation function. So for instance, here I give some Euclidean time epsilon 1 to this operator, epsilon 2 to this operator, epsilon 3, epsilon 4, for instance, Euclidean times, and I order them such that epsilon 1 is less than epsilon 2, is less than epsilon 3, is less than epsilon 4. And so to get this ordering, I would consider different Euclidean offsets. And so I start with 0 Lorentzian time, then some small Euclidean offsets, and then I increase Lorentzian time and follow the path of the cross ratio z in a complex z plane. And as a reminder, there's a branch cut running from 1 to infinity in the complex z plane, and whether or not I cross the branch cut or not tells us how to continue this correlation function. So for instance, for this red ordering, nothing interesting happens, so I can evaluate this correlator on the primary sheet. For this blue ordering of interest, we see that, in fact, we do go around and cross the branch cut running from 1 to infinity, and so that tells us that chaos, to diagnose or to compute this correlation function, we need to analytically continue to the second sheet. And so the interesting behavior in terms of chaos is determined by the second sheet of the Euclidean four-point function. So, good. Now let's consider some examples. First, let's consider the large CCFT with a sparse low line spectrum. So the Virasoro identity block, of course chaos should be related to what theory we're considering. So it somehow has to depend on the spectrum. And so in this case, we're going to make a sparseness assumption about the spectrum. And so the assumption we're going to make is that the Virasoro identity block approximates the entire four-point function. So the identity block includes all powers and derivatives of the stress tensor. And so for an appropriately sparse spectrum, we can take this to approximate the full correlator. For large C, these Virasoro conformal blocks were computed by Fitzpatrick, Kaplan, and Walters. Before I reproduce the formula here. Here, HW and HV are the conformal weights of the operators W and V, and C is the central charge. And so it's clear that there's, again, a branch cut running from 1 to infinity, and it's very easy to continue this. And so evaluating this on both the primary and second sheet, we can see first that this red ordered correlator is equal to 1, as expected. And this blue ordered correlator, we see it is in fact decaying exponentially in time for all choices of these operators, W and V. And the rate of decay does depend on the conformal weight of the V operator, but we see that this is the behavior that we expected. After a delay related to the distance between the operators, this correlation function is going to 0 for all choices of operators. There's also appearing is this factor T star, which is known as the fast graveling time of Hayden, Preskill, and Sakino and Suskind. It's given by beta over 2 pi log of the central charge. And one can think about this as a delay related to the number of degrees of freedom per site or the matrix directions. For instance, if I perturb, this operator can not only grow out in spatial directions, but also in its matrix directions. And that's one way to think about this G star. I should also add that the full result, I've taken a late time limit here, but the entire result matches the original holographic computation of Steve Schaefer and Douglas Stanford. Good. So this theory is chaotic by our measure. Now let's consider the 2D Ising model. 2D Ising model is a well-known example of an integrable system. And as a sanity check, we should make sure that this theory does not, that our measure agrees with this theory being integrable. So there's 3 Virasoro primary operators, and we can just compute the correlators exactly. So these are Euclidean correlators. And only the 4 sigma correlator, and I've suppressed the time arguments, but this is the alternating time argument. So only the 4 sigma correlator vanishes at large t. The other ones do other things, and so since this doesn't happen for all choices of operators, this does not satisfy our criteria for being chaotic or diagnostic, and so which is great because it's not. Good. So now that we have understood how to diagnose chaos and what chaos means, and that's related to the growth of operators due to the butterfly effect, let's now address the related question of scrambling. I should pause and ask if there are any questions before we go on. Cool. So scrambling. So the question of scrambling is different. It's the question of, given some pure state on A and B, if I only am allowed access to a small part of the system on A, and I can do local measurements on A, can I learn anything about the state just by considering measurements on A? And there's a slightly more formal definition considered by Page, Ms. Kino, and Suskind. And my main takeaway from this, this is taken to mean a trace distance, and basically it checks whether it's a question of whether the density matrix on A is maximally mixed or proportional to the identity or not. And if it's maximally mixed, then the state is said to be scrambled because you can't learn anything by doing measurements on it. And the thing I learned from this is that apparently local means less than half of the system. Good. So scrambled states are scrambling is related to entanglement, because when you throw a some part of it, where you consider just a small part of the system, if it looks random, the other half of the system is in effect acting as a bat, and due to entanglement, and the information is encoded in the entanglement between that part of the system and the other part of the system. And so the question I want to address is, what kind of operators can scramble many states? So I start with some collection of states where I have localized information, and I want to understand what classes of operators take localized information and delocalize it. And Page originally showed that this is true for generic or HAR random operators, so operators sampled from the HAR measure, where finally for all finely tuned states, essentially, or any reference state, is taken to a generic scrambled state, and then was able to show, for instance, that this relationship holds. But the question is this too strong? Are there other choices of operators that aren't HAR random that scramble? And it's been argued in slightly different contexts that the answer is yes. And so what I'd like to develop is a notion of scrambling purely in terms of operators. So here's an example of an operator. This is some unitary operator parameterized by some t. So think about it as time, and we will think about it as a time evolution operator. An operator is a tensor, so we can think about it as having input legs and output legs. And I've divided my input legs into two groups, A and B. I've divided my output legs into two groups, C and D. And this is a representation of that operator in the basis of, you know, in terms of these legs. And there's a couple of important points. One is that what operator I'm considering is encoded in these coefficients, uij. And if my operator maps that, for instance, an n-spin state to an n-spin state, then there's 2 to the n times 2 to the n of these coefficients, or 2 to the 2n of these coefficients. What I can do is, so that means that it lives on, in a sense, so that means that there's a natural isomorphism between where this operator lives and a 2 to the 2n dimensional Hilbert space. So what I can do is I can map this operator to a state. And so what I've done down here essentially is I've just flipped the bra around to become a ket, and I've added a normalization because I want to think of this as a state. What I've done in terms of this picture is I've just taken the input legs and bent them around to become output legs. But of course, since this encodes the same uij, the same coefficients, so this must contain all the information that our original operator contained. So another point is that if this mapping is troubling to you somehow, you can instead think of this as the following process, whereby you create a maximally entangled state, so a collection of bell pairs, and you take one end and you just do nothing to them, and you take the other ends, and then you apply this operator, you apply the operator u. And so, and these are mathematically equivalent. So there's some, in this case, we're in a sense creating some copy of our input that we're going to give to this operator, and then we have an entangled copy of the input with the output. Whereas here, it's just that I just think of it as a mapping between these two objects. So the reason I'm doing this is to develop this idea of a unitary quantum channel. I just want to say that this is not something that's totally unfamiliar. The thermal field double state, which is the state that I've written down here, where Z is the thermal partition function, is a familiar example of a unitary channel. And so in this case, if I trace out, say, one half of the system, I'm left with a purely thermal state. But the nice part about the thermal field double state is that I can evolve it. Is, for instance, I can evolve it in time, and then I have an entangled copy of my input with my output, and then you can do things, for instance, like compute entropies involving both the input and the output. Before I go on, I just want to say that the reason I say channels and not operators is that a unitary channel includes, for instance, non-unitary operators, which is what one way of thinking about what this is, since you have this thermal density matrix, in a sense, in here. Good. So why bother with this at all? The reason is because we're interested in a notion of entanglement in time. So what we can do is we can take our state interpretation of the unitary operator, we can compute a density matrix, And then we can do things, for instance, like trace out the right half. So here I've traced out the input legs B, I've traced out the output legs D, and I can now, for instance, compute the entanglement between the left and the right, or the second radiance between the left and the right. Very naturally, you can also consider the mutual information between A and B, and that's telling you, in a sense, something very nice. That tells you that if I inject some sort of information in A, what happens to it in the output? So it tells me, it's a notion of how information is flowing under this evolution, and that's precisely the question that we're interested in. To make this a bit more concrete, let me consider some examples. So here I have the identity operator. The depiction of this is that whatever is on A is just mapped to C, whatever is on B just maps to D, and in terms of state, this is just a collection of bell pairs between the input and the output. That's sort of an interesting way to think of a quantum computation. It's just the input is always maximally entangled with the output, because if you put something into a circuit, it has to end up somewhere in the output, and it's just a question of how are they connected, or how is the input entangled with the output. And so, for instance, we can use this to compute mutual information. So for instance, we can compute the information between A and CD. This is just a question of, if I have some, if I inject some information in A, it has to end up somewhere in the output, because CD is the entire output. And the reason this is true is that there's two reasons to understand why this is true. First is that for this part I'm just thinking of A, B, C, D as just single spins. So if A is a spin, then there's basically four different operators that I can act with on A. I can act with I, I can act with X, Y, or Z, the three non-trivial poly operators. So there's four different types of inputs that takes two bits to describe, and so that's why this is two. So the amount of information that I can input into A is two bits. Alternatively, in terms of just looking at this picture, the mutual information roughly is the number of bell pairs shared between the two systems. So in this case, there's exactly one bell pair shared between the A system and the CD system. We can also consider just the mutual information between A and C. And again, it's two for essentially the same reason that I just described. There's one bell pair shared between the A and C systems. And so what this tells us is that if I put information in A, it has to end up somewhere in the output, and it ends up precisely in C. So I inject localized information and it stays localized. Well, I can also ask about the mutual information between A and D, and then this is zero. So there's no shared bell pairs between this system, and if I inject information in A, it doesn't end up in D. And so this system doesn't scramble. Localized information stays localized under the evolution. Of course, that's what we expect. It's the identity operator, so nothing should happen. Everything should just stay where it is. And that's what we're seeing here. But this is one way to understand in terms of how the information is flowing. We can consider a non-trivial, let's consider a slightly more non-trivial evolution. So this is the swap operator. So here I map A to D, I map B to C, and so this is the picture here. And so we can ask the same sort of questions. So first we say, first this has to be true, this is always going to be true, so the information in A has to end up somewhere in the output, but in this case it doesn't end up in C, it ends up in D. And so in this case, something changed, it's not the identity, but instead the localized information ended up somewhere else, it ended up in D. So we moved it, but we didn't delocalize it. So this system doesn't scramble, it doesn't take localized information and delocalize it. So let's finally consider something actually non-trivial. And so this X is supposed to represent some sort of non-trivial evolution between these four sites, or between these two sites, and for instance, some sort of interaction. And a nice stand-in for this is what's called a perfect tensor. The key takeaways of this is one that so the state in C depends on both what was in A and B. Same thing for the state in D depends on both what was A and B, because of these JIs, these IJs. Let me just, as an aside, tell you the properties about perfect tensors. that you need to know in order to compute these informations. So perfect tensors have the very nice property that they're maximally entangled across any live partition. So here, if I partition it like this, then I can, the entanglement is related like this. If I partition it like this, then the entanglement is related like this. So it's always maximally entangled across its five partitions. So we can use this now to ask the same questions about this tensor, about this evolution. And so first, just if I inject something in A, of course, as a unitary operator, it has to, you know, the information has to end up somewhere in the output, so this is still two. But we can also now ask, did it end up in C? Using the properties of perfect tensors, we understand the entanglement is like this. There's no shared Bell pairs between A and C. Mutual information between A and C is zero. Similarly, we can ask about the mutual information between A and D. In this case, again, we know it's maximally entangled across any bipartition, and so that's also zero. So this is very interesting. We've injected information in A, it ends up somewhere in the output, but it didn't end up in C, and it also didn't end up in D. And so this system scrambles. And so just to summarize, we have no, no, yes, and just sort of looking at these informations, this suggests that a natural measure of scrambling is, so I injected some sort of information, it ended up in the output, but it didn't end up in one partition, and it didn't end up in that partition's complement. So this is, in some sense, a very natural notion of what it means to scramble for an operator. And before we go on, I just want to highlight something that I find interesting, which is the similarity between these diagrams that I've drawn, these tensors, and what you would, in the Feynman diagrams, you would draw in a 2-to-2 scattering process. So here, these are in effect the diagrams you draw for a non-interacting theory. So just have the trivial part of the S matrix. And then if, for instance, we had a four-point interaction, this is the first sort of interaction diagram we draw. And so the reason that I find this interesting is that to the extent that we can think of information being carried or entanglement being carried by quasi-particles, this suggests that in order to scramble, we need to consider interacting quasi-particles. They can't just pass right through each other. And this sort of makes sense because if we think about what it means for information to process, we can't just push things around and have nothing happen. We need to have some sort of interaction in order for things to scramble or process. So this quantity that I drew, actually the negative of the quantity on the previous slide, is known as the tripartite information. Here I've written it out in terms of entropies. It's for a pure state, A, B, C, D. It's symmetric under the interchange of any of the partitions. So that's why there's no arguments here. But in terms of the way we're thinking about it, it's very natural to consider injecting from the question of what happens to information in A and whether it ends up in a particular partition of the output or its complement. And we know that this is in effect precisely constant for any evolution. And so the claim is that this negativity of this, or large negative values of I3 is a natural measure of the scrambling power of the operator. Good. Any questions? Good.
Okay, so do you think that the theory is really if that I think it's zero? Are you correct?
My claim would be that if I3 is zero, it doesn't scramble.
Okay. But it doesn't necessarily mean the theory is free.
It doesn't necessarily mean the theory is free, but it would be surprising if it were not free. Mm-hmm. If it's zero.
Yeah.
Okay. So good. Now that we studied these simple examples, which are just involved, small numbers of degrees of freedom, let's try to understand more generally what are the properties of an operator that enable it to scramble. As I mentioned in the beginning, generic operators or operators sampled from the Haar ensemble they scramble, and they also have, you can use the techniques of Haar integrals to compute the tripartite information for a random operator, and it's constrained to be within one bit of the minimum value. Now, the minimum value is given by the minimum of of the minimum entropy of between the four different partitions. And so if, for instance, I divide my partitions equally, I can take these, or if I take these partitions to scale with the size of the system, this is getting large for large systems, and this is some order one number. So in terms of a fraction of in terms of a fraction of in terms of a fraction of I3 har over I3 minimum, this is going to very this is going to zero. So a har random operator will have near minimal tripartite information and thus which is good because it scrambles. But what are the properties of operators in general that determine whether finely tuned states are taken to more generic states? Well, this sounds a lot like chaos. And so the thing that I want to do right now is tie this to what we mentioned in the beginning of the talk. Try and understand precise relationship between chaos and scrambling. Chaos we talked about in terms of these four-point functions, and scrambling we've now talked about it in terms of some information theoretic quantity of a unitary operator. And so this logic suggests that they should be related, but it would be nice to understand precisely how that they're related. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take an average of the blue alternatingly ordered correlation functions between operators constrained to two different regions. So here I'm considering this is the system, the spatial extent of the system, and this is at two different times. And so at the initial time, I consider some partitioning, and I consider some region A, and then I want to consider correlation functions between the operators that live in A, and then at some later time, I'm going to consider some other partitioning, and I want to consider the operators of correlation functions with the operators that live in D, in turn, precisely these out-of-time order correlation functions. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to consider a complete basis of operators in D, and similarly, a complete basis of operators in A, a complete and orthogonal basis, that's what this condition means, and then I'm going to compute the average over all such correlation functions. And so when I talk about the definition of chaos, originally I said that you should check for all such correlation functions that they decay, and so a natural thing to do is just average them and see what the average behavior is. This actually has a very simple expression, and so it turns out that it's proportional to the entropy in B minus the entropy in D minus the second remaining entropy computed between A and C. So that's, again, taking the unitary operator U and interpreting it as a state and then computing the remaining entropy, basically tracing out the right half of the system, B and D, and computing the remaining entropy between A and C. I guess very briefly, the proof of this is actually rather simple. So as a reminder, this is the formula, the density matrix between A and C. So I've traced out B and D. And this identity tells me what happens if I do an average over these operators here. So if I average these operators over a complete basis, this tells me that either I get the identity, or I trace out, the region in which that operator has support that I've averaged over the complete basis in. And so, in fact, I think this identity is what it means for a collection of operators to be complete. And so I just use this twice. So this diagram is the expression of this four-point correlation function. These are the A operators, these are the D operators, and then these U's represent the time evolution. And so I just apply this identity twice, and then I get this answer, which or something proportional to this answer, which is a formula for 2 to the minus second remaining entropy. And so why is this useful? So we know that the out-of-time order correlation functions decay to some epsilon, or let's assume that they decay to some epsilon. Then we can use this to bound by considering different intervals or different partitions. We can use this to bound the tripartite information, so the difference between the tripartite information and its minimum, to be in terms of this epsilon. And what this tells us is that the butterfly effect, the decay of these correlation functions, implies scrambling, which is the fact that the tripartite information of the system will go to its har random value. And so, in fact, chaos is what drives the delocalization of information or drive scrambling. To try and see how this works a little more clearly, we can consider the same spin chain system that we considered at the beginning of the talk. So here, this is the same Hamiltonian I started with. And now, so I'm considering a chaotic system with g equals minus 1.05 and h equals 0.5. And also, I'm considering an integrable system with g equals 1 and h equals 0. And this is the integrable transverse quantizing model. And so the integrable system is in blue, the chaotic system is in orange, and then I'll also consider a hard random or generic operator in black. And I'm considering equal partitioning. So I have A and B, they're both 3 qubits each, and then I do time evolution, and then I have C and D, and they're also 3 qubits each. And so let's, and now I've plotted different information theoretic quantities of interest. So let's first talk about the mutual information between A and C. So here I start, here it starts at 6, because there's 6 bits of information, because there's now, one way of thinking about this is at t equals 0, there's 3 Bell pairs between A and C, paired between A and C. Just connect the identity operator. And under time evolution, for both types of systems, this is just decaying linearly in time. In fact, the slope is precisely this tsunami or entanglement velocity that people tend to talk about in particular in relation to holography. The information decreases linearly in time, and that's due to the fact that the operators in A, as we know, they're growing outwards and they're extending into D. And when they extend into D, then information is being lost between A and C. Now, if we consider the mutual information between A and D, this starts at 0 because at t equals 0, there's non-overlapping support between these sets of operators. And then for the chaotic system, it increases a tiny bit and then basically saturates at the hard random value. However, for the integrable system, we see that it begins to increase well past that and increases to quite a lot. So the picture here is that for the integrable system, information is about from about A is leaving C, but it's going into D, and then eventually the information shifts back and starts coming back to C, and it decreases from D. And so this is precisely like the swap operator that this is the swap operator that we considered in the middle of the talk, where information is staying localized, it's just switching back and forth where it is between C and D. Instead, for the chaotic system, information starts out localized and then it decays over time, and it never shows up in any subsystem. And so, as I've argued, the tripartite information is in fact a very nice measure of this. So here I plotted the negative of the tripartite information normalized by its maximal value. So the maximal value is 1. The hard random operator has 0.77. This is a finite size effect. For large system sizes, this would go to 1. And I see that the chaotic system, the tripartite information increases linearly in time until it saturates at roughly the hard random value, whereas for the integrable system, it doesn't increase very much at all, and it stays at for a long time at a much lower value. And so this supports our interpretation of the tripartite information as being a measure, in a sense, a measure of the power of scrambling, scrambling power of an operator. And we see that for their integrable systems, it never gets very large, and for chaotic systems, it gets very large. So chaos is related to scrambling. So good. So what will lead us into the final section is the following idea. So it takes order entropy time, or order the number of degrees of freedom for these information theoretic quantities to reach their hard random or late time values. And so one can say that this linear spin chain scrambles in a time proportional to S. But the question is there any natural clock or after that time? Does the system stop changing, or is there any measure of or notion of what's happening in the system? As Susskind likes to emphasize, entanglement is not enough to diagnose that. This is very explicit from these plots, although one in principle needs to change the size of the system to see this, but the saturation time here happens at a time that's proportional to the entropy, or this saturation time here, proportional to the size of the system. So, and this is a very short, this is a very short time for a lot of systems. And so, is there any natural clock? And so the claim by a lot of people, ideas began by Susskind is that the computational complexity of the state is the thing that continues to increase once these entropies saturate after the system thermalizes. And so just going to very briefly describe what computational complexity is, and then finally relate this back to ideas in holography, which is my initial motivation. So the point here is that I'm just going to take the time evolution operator, and I want to consider a discretization. And since my Hamiltonian is local, I know that I can think about this operator as just involving sort of local interactions between neighboring degrees of freedom. And so in terms of a quantum circuit, I can think about that as applying gates between neighboring degrees of freedom. And so this x here is supposed to represent that gate between degrees of freedom I and I plus one. And I can think about what coefficients I put here, either by exponentiating the terms in that Hamiltonian for a very short time. That's in some sense a good notion of the evolution between neighboring degrees of freedom. Or perhaps I could use some variational procedure to try and pick the coefficients here that for a long evolution match it well. But this procedure is often called where you do it like this is often called trotterization. And there's just a nice notion there's a natural way in which one can do this. And the point here is that, so since this just involves neighboring degrees of freedom and some small choice of coefficients, this is, the complexity of this is just order one. It's very, in terms of how hard it is to describe, it's very simple, or just in terms of, if I think about this as a gate in a circuit, I can think about this as one gate in the circuit. And so the question is, what happens as you evolve in time? How many of these such gates does it take to describe the evolution? Here I'm going to show you a cartoon of how this works. So this is just the identity at zero time, and so I have nothing here. And then I apply gates, these x's between neighboring degrees of freedom. And so what you see is that basically this increases linearly in time. So the number of these such x's, it's just a very regular pattern and increases linearly in time. And so this is in fact sort of by design or how we were thinking about this. And another important point is that the rate of growth of complexity, so it's both related to the number of degrees of freedom or the entropy, and it's also related to the temperature. And a good way of thinking about that is that I have, every time I apply a gate, it's like I have an interaction, and I can have interactions roughly every thermal time. So just the notion of how fast things are mixing or things are interacting. And so this final point I've just borrowed from complexity theorists, which is that the complexity has a maximum at e to the s for say s qubits or s spins, and hard random operators, generic operators that we've been talking about will have exponential complexity. And so in principle, this is a nice quantity that can, for a unitary operator, this quantity is expected to start at zero and increase for a very long time for an exponential amount of time. So this is precisely the sort of clock that we'd be looking for that would continue to increase after time s, or after time polynomial in s. So with the final couple of minutes, I just want to ask, what is the holographic dual of a unitary quantum channel, or of a unit of these sorts of circuits that we've been considering in this talk? And also I want to say that up to this point, I hope that I've been rather technically precise. I've presented calculations and explicit examples in terms of spin chains. Now I'm going to indulge in some conjecturing and speculation. So this part is fine. So first, there's a notion of, so following the work of Swingle, Hartmann and Maldacena proposed that the interior of a black hole, or the Einstein-Rosen bridge, is a tensor network or a discretization of time evolution. So this is the same sort of network that I drew on my previous slide, a very regular network where the tensors occur at these these crosses. And so what they studied in this paper is that they studied the time evolution of the thermal field double state, and they showed that the entropy of the entanglement entropy, say, of half the system, which is analogous to the SAC that we considered the entanglement, the left-right entanglement, grows linearly with time. And a related calculation shows that this system scrambles in a sense of tripartite information at a time of order of the black hole entropy, and it goes precisely to its maximal value. So this, in terms of our definition, is a maximal scrambler, and it happens very, very quickly at time of order s. But by inserting geometric quantities between the two boundaries, either say geodesics in a VTZ geometry or higher or codimension one surfaces, so in a sense trying to get an idea of the volume of the Einstein-Rosen bridge of the galactical interior as you involve in time, these things just continue to grow in time long past a time of order the entropy. And so the question is, what is this growth dual to? But hopefully, based on what I've been saying so far, and the fact that this thermal field double state, this Paternò black hole in EDS, is just the same sorts of circuits that we've been considering in this talk, that this growth or this geometric increase of the interior is somehow related to computational complexity. So first, I need some notion of what it means to have or some geometrically invariant notion of the interior. So I'm going to define it as follows. Consider fixing the boundaries to be two different times, so the left boundary TL equals 0, the right boundary TR equals T, and then consider the union of all spatial slices anchored at the boundaries at those two points. That defines this gray diamond here, which I denote the Wheeler-DeWitt patch. Other people, I think, call this the domain of dependence, but I'm going to use the term Wheeler-DeWitt patch. And so now take the geometry, the equations of motions, and then plug that back into the action and compute the on-shell action restricted to this patch. And so the conjecture is that the complexity of the field theory state, the CFT state, is equal to the action of the solution restricted to this patch. Again, because this is a nice geometric notion of that encodes the growth of this interior, for instance, under time evolution. So aside from the fact that these things both grow linearly in time, there's actually a lot of non-trivial evidence for this in terms of applying operators to the boundaries and computing complexity, considering cases where things should cancel and one should see sort of a non-trivial agreement between the geometry and the Einstein-Rosen bridge and the expected complexity or the expected tensor network representation of the field theory state. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go into that, so instead I'm just going to indulge in another wild speculation. And thus, so it's a fact that this action, the rate of change of this action, is always less than 2m, where m is the mass of the black hole. This is true in all dimensions, black holes of all different sizes, and in fact, neutral black holes will saturate this bound in all dimensions. And so our claim is that neutral black holes are then the fastest computers in nature. If you accept complexity or the growth of these circuits as a notion, as a stand-in for what we mean by computation. So they're the fastest complexifiers, and so we claim that they're the fastest computers in nature. That's all I have. Thank you.
I guess the theory is that in the international symmetry, the theory is genetically non-chaotic. But on the other hand, in 2D CFT, there always is international symmetry, which is the Virasoro symmetry. Mm-hmm. So do you have any idea which kind of 2D CFT is chaotic or which is not?
Yeah, I know exactly which ones are chaotic and not. So you can interpret. It's really a question about the spectrum. And the calculation that I showed suggests that you require a very special sparseness condition in order for the theory to be chaotic, for instance. So there's a paper by Tom Hartman and some collaborators about the radiant entropy of two intervals, or it's about called entanglement scrambling CFT or something like that. It involves considering a memory effect with two different intervals and after a quench. And the paper is called entanglement scrambling, but I don't think that at the time they realized it was precisely the same notion of scrambling that people had generally meant. But it turns out it is, and it's driven precisely by chaos due to the arguments that I've given in this talk. In that paper, they give a criteria for deciding when a theory has a memory effect or not. And it's, they define basically a notion of the number of conserved currents. They define the density of currents, and they fit it to a Cardi-like formula. And where the central charge goes, they call that a dense C currents. And the statement for there to be a memory effect in their paper was that the number of C currents must be less than the central charge. And following that through, in terms of this paper, in terms of the results I've presented here, you can use that to interpret that entire paper's statements about which 2D CFTs are chaotic or not. And no surprise, for instance, most of them are not chaotic. Well, most of the ones that we know and study are not chaotic. For instance, the minimal models are not chaotic. Of course, you should expect that because you can compute whatever you want about them. So actually, one of the things I'm doing right now is trying to translate that paper in terms of chaos. But the statement, it's a statement about, just more generally, it's a statement about the spectrum, and it's precisely that this number of currents should be less than the central charge. And that sort of makes sense given sort of these, where it's not too different from the classical notion of integrability, where you need to have the number of conserved quantities to be equal to the Gray dimension.
Is it a known thing that an integrable theory can't be chaotic?
Well, it depends what you mean by integrable and chaotic. I mean,
this is why I'm confused, because sometimes people say the definition of integrability is the existence of these higher conserved charges. But yes. By that definition, we would say all CFTs are integrable, but.
Right, so.
2D CFTs, sorry. But the.
Right, so. People, so my definition would be, I guess, in terms of whether operators have the butterfly effect, whether they grow. And that's related to this question of the C currents and how it relates to the central charge for 2D CFT. You might mean by integrable that all correlation functions are computable. But for instance, there's this new model of Kataev and based on the model of Sacha de Vignier, and that, for instance, you can compute the correlation functions, but it's maximally chaotic and in a precise sense that I presented in this talk. And it's interacting, so it's not free, it's not trivial. And so, again, it depends what you mean by these things. If you use these steps, I think this is the right way to think about it.
I guess if you do use this definition that there are higher conserved charges in the CFT case, which people don't really know how to. There are many CFTs where people can't use these higher conserved charges to compute them.
Sorry, which currents, or what do you mean by?
I just mean that some people, well,
which,
one yeah. Definition of integrability would be that you can compute the S matrix because of the higher conserved. So you'd say there's these higher conserved charges, so the S matrix factorizes, and then you compute the 2-to-2 scattering from that you construct everything. Right?
Mm-hmm. Well, the correlation, if this out of time over correlator factorizes, then it's not. I mean, then it's not chaotic, right? Then these operators don't grow. You need those not to factorize. You need those to.
Yeah, all I wanted to say within the CFT case, of course, people don't know how to realize that program, even though there are these higher conserved charges.
Mm-hmm. So. I mean, in general, I think that chaos and sort of is a manifestation of an interacting theory. The chaos and scrambling are a manifestation of interactions. And in some cases, you can compute a notion of a Lyapunov exponent for these strongly coupled quantum systems and relate that in a sense to how the coupling works and that sort of the logic that we should expect.